Overture, would you like to start with where you were born and raised?
I was born in Victoria.
Okay.
18th June 1932. I was raised in Victoria, a very young child. And the family moved to Malta when I was less than 2 years old, went to London, and my mother died. And then back to Canada and Quebec. Quebec for a few years, and then back out here. And then went to high school in Vancouver.
And were you a military family? Was your father in the military?
My father was in the Navy.
Okay.
He was one of the initial class of six cadets who joined in 1910, actually joined in 1909 before he became a Navy. And he retired as a rear admiral out here. He was the commander of the Pacific Coast during the war. From an army family. And but, she died, of course, when I was very young. And I certainly came from this much.
So, a strong military background. Was that, did you always know that you were going to pursue the military?
No, I don't think it really struck me. Although, during the war in Vancouver, I was in the army cadets. Fusiliers, as a matter of fact. I toyed with joining the militia, but decided against it. Just about the time I entered the UBC, I had the toss up of either getting into the UBC nuclear program, which was just starting. They had got a generator at that time, and the draft generator, I think, which was the first thing I had gathered out here.
And what were your reasons behind that, rather than to perhaps go to UBC?
Well, I think the number of things the family association with me. My grandfather was a minister of the Table of the Bill, which created me. Fisheries on the civil fisheries. And he introduced them for the prepared for the fisheries, the possible retirements, before he introduced them. And then my father, of course, got so I guess it seemed logical.
Natural progression.
Yeah, natural progression.
And you received quite a lot of different training. In the Navy, but when you first started out?
Well, your initial training was at the Royal Rose Military College. Right. I was there for 2 years. Then went over to be going along with my confreres and floor guarding. Graduated from the Royal Rose as a midshipman. Joined a cruiser for 16 months as a midshipman. We had two cruisers in the States, Ontario. Then went to an aircraft carrier, one of the magnificent it was in those days, for 4 months. And then went over to England on the Silverstone's courses and joined me in England. We were married in Greenwich. Greenwich for what was known as Junior Officers War Course. Summer's courses in the south of England. And they involved courses in gunnery, torpedo and submarine, damage control, amphibious warfare, communications, navigation. Those were courses that you could take those summer's done. Then came back here.
Now, as a midshipman, what would your duties be?
In Ontario, you basically would understudy senior officers, but you also would get quite a few courses of engineering and seamanship, a lot of seamanship, which goes on the cruise. And you had to keep a journal. I'll show you the journal tomorrow. And you had to keep a seamanship notebook. And you had to develop the skill of drawing. Engineering drawing in another part. And then you would get courses on the weaponry in that ship. Now, the Ontario had 6-inch guns. So it would be shipping of a turret, a 6-inch turret. She had 9 6-inch guns and 3 turrets. And you'd do gunnery training in the ship as well. You and your fellow midshipmen. And a 4-inch gun and fire it. Because they have 4-inch guns as well, secondary animals. One turret, 4-inch guns. And a lot of what we call officer watch training, where you learn how to take charge of the ship and see it night to day. That's basically it. You were kept busy. I
can imagine.
And the ship would go on cruises, so you can see other things as well.
Yeah. Now, through the Naval Board, there was a conversion of the U.S. or the Canadian ships to a U.S. compatibility. Were they doing that when you were aboard, or was that done previous to you?
No, our ships, all of our. Our naval traditions and our ships were really Roman. The cruisers were ex-Royal Navy cruisers. The aircraft carrier Magnuson's nice, white fleet carrier, Royal Navy. Our tribal class destroyers, as well as in Canada, were built after the Royal Navy tribal class destroyers. Similarly, armed. The first time that we built our own destroyers, Samoan class. And although some people may say that was a conversion or association with the U.S. Navy predicated, I would say no. The sonar, for example, the sonar is a merchant. The searcher sonar is an American sonar. The scanner sonar is an American sonar. The attacker sonar is British sonar. The underwater telephone was Canadian. The bottom search sonar was a British sonar. The anti-submarine weapon was a British Mortimer 10 weapon. The gun was a 3-inch, 70-caliber British weapon, British gun, automatic gun. The gun aft was an American 3-inch 50. The construction and the communications is mostly Canadian. The sub-interoperability can go through all the U.S. Navy. So I don't think you could say, if anything, we in the Canadian Navy always picked and chose the
best of everything.
The best that we could get, could afford to buy,
yeah.
Of what we used to be either the U.S. Navy or either the British Navy or the U.S. Navy.
Now, prior to the Cuban Missile Crisis, what was Cuba on the Canadian Navy's radar, or was that not really an issue for them?
No, that crisis that materialized very quickly. At that time, definitely the Soviets. Mm-hmm. And most of our tactics and tactical doctrine. Of course, on this coast, there was also the experience of Korea. But the naval engagement on this coast of Korea was largely that of the gunships with our tribal class destroyers, which had good armament. shell of shore. So it was essentially our tactics, our doctrine, our training was heavily anti-submarine warfare because that's what the nature of men is going to Soviet submarine.
Now, in that doctrine, was this a strictly Canadian, or was this part of a U.S.-Canadian strategy, or did the Canadian Navy have their own?
We basically, up to that time, we basically developed our own tactics and our own strategy through a combination of things. Like, for example, the Maritime Warfare School in Halifax, it would have British officers on staff, American officers on staff. It would have flyers, pilots on staff, fixed-wing pilots, patrol aircraft, tracker aircraft, and it would have helicopter pilots. In fact, composite staff. And I like to think that we were very good at looking at the doctrines that the U.S. Navy used, looking at the doctrines that the Royal Navy used, and producing our own doctrine, our own publications, except those publications which were made in the we contributed to the naval publications as well. There's a lot behind what I say. It would be very wrong for anybody to say that we're other nations.
Now, at the time, you were a weapons officer aboard the HMCS Kootenai.
Yeah.
And can you tell me about how many men were aboard?
We had
200. And the Kootenai was a destroyer escort.
She was a destroyer escort of the Restigouche class.
Okay. Could you describe the ship a little bit?
Well, let's see. Slightly over 300 feet in length. Displaced about 2,800 tons. Had a 3-inch 70 caliber mounting forward. Had a 3-inch 50 caliber mounting aft. Had a motor part cap. An M70 torpedo mark 44. Had a speed capability of around 20 knots, and would stay at sea without fuel for 7 days, but I needed 4 days.
Okay.
That's about it.
Okay. Now, in regards to the Soviet equipment that they had, how aware was the Canadian Navy of the equipment that they were operating? You had a good idea.
Yeah.
The amount of men.
Yeah. You see, within the NATO context, intelligence was very well shared between all the nations. So we had a good idea. We knew what a Foxtrot submarine was. What its capabilities were. We had an idea what its armaments were. In this case, it's definitely believed, and I think it's true, that we had nuclear intent torpedoes. Verify this general concept is that those are long range torpedoes and you can stand on the carry them into the harbor.
Now, as the weapons officer at the time, I understand that you did a fair amount of anti submarine warfare training in England.
That was initially as sub lieutenant.
Oh, okay.
But later on, after England came out here, from 1955 to 1960 at sea in frigates out here, almost entirely. Well, first with the cruiser, and then I served in 2 frigates, and then I was executive officer of 1 frigate. Then I went back east, and I took a long course, as we call it, which was a 13-month course in weaponry, and I was anti-submarine and tracking, essentially.
So how many people aboard would have had a similar kind of training like this? Everybody was fairly familiar with anti-submarine. Just you?
I had an assistant weapons officer. I'm trying to remember if he was on board at the time or not, whatever it was. I had an assistant, but he would not necessarily have been at the law enforcement sector. The non-commissioned officers, the specialists, some of them, for example, electronics technicians or the weapons surface technician, each specializing in this area. So they were specialists, but it was up to me to head the department and supervise their operations and training, their control on that situation.
Okay, so I have kind of a long question, but I understand on the 22nd of October, the National Defense Headquarters in Canada received notice that the U.S. military had raised their DEFCON alert to 3, and through NATO had expected that the Canadian military would do the same.
I'm not sure whether it would be through NATO, because in addition to our NATO agreements, we also have Canada-U.S. defense agreements as well.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I think probably... it's going back too far, so I can't, nor would I, as a lieutenant, necessarily involved with that level.
Right. Okay. I was wondering if there was, if there was any fallout within the military of the reluctance to raise the alert. I understand that some kind of informal measures were taken to ready the military.
Well, it had to be done. You see, we had defense agreements, and the defense agreements normally, although there was a tendency of political masters in Canada pretending defense agreements don't exist. By the turn of the line, that has been a tendency. There was certainly a tendency back in that time. Go ahead, make your agreements, but don't bother me. Don't tell me.
Especially at the crucial time.
Well, the agreements were made before it. I mean, anything, when Admiral Dyer sailed the fleet of sailed the Red Hornets, he did that in accordance with prearranged agreements. He did not do it unilaterally on his own property, although committing Canadian forces was his decision at the time, because he was a commander in America of the Navy and these guns. His responsibility. I would say there were probably a lot of us who were, well, once we got to see, we were too busy. Things were on the way up, probably thinking, you know, when the house counted, we stepped up, and counted on the street.
Now, on the Kootenai, you left or went in to be loaded up with ammunition on the 25th.
Yeah.
And were you guys aware of what was happening then, or you were just told you had to come back in? And
we were aware.
You knew what was going on. So I've heard before that some of the U.S. military sites were evacuating their families off the bases. Was there any talk about that? No, nothing like that.
No. This was right at the beginning. Nobody knew how it was going to play out. Nobody knew what was going to happen. It wasn't as though a war had been declared and now we must do something about protecting our families. You're in a situation of great uncertainty at that time. I'm sure the consciousness descended on all of us, you know, saying to us, oh God, I hope this doesn't come to pass. If there were measures being taken and planning being taken to evacuate families, it would have been done at the headquarters level in Halifax. And we wouldn't necessarily have course, such plans only become more public knowledge when they are implemented.
Now, because you were operating sort of on your own without the government acting, was there any concern that there would be any sort of fallout of that? Or obviously not to yourself, because it wasn't your decision, but...
No, that would be a political consideration. As the captain, as Pat Brown said, the rules of engagement, we basically, we're following Canadian rules of engagement. The rule of engagement specifies what you may do under every situation. It specifies whether you consider the hostile eye, hostile intent, and what to do in act and respond. In later years, we have Canadian rules of engagement, we have NATO rules of engagement, we have Canada US rules of engagement. Rules of engagement apply only until first shot is fired. Thereafter, it becomes straight to the target.
Yes. Yeah. So when you went out on the 25th, you were under Commander Dyers?
Under Admiral Dyers.
Admiral Dyers.
But the tactical command was being exercised by the squadron
commander. Okay.
And then if a ship was sent into a U.S. sector, or there was a U.S. commander, then he would be given a form of command. Now, the forms of command are many. There's operational command, there's operational control, there's tactical command, and there's tactical control. And in this case, I could imagine to say that we were turned over to them for tactical control. Mm-hmm. But operational command still vested in the admiral, our admiral.
Yeah. But you were worked into kind of what was going on in American waters.
Yes, that's right.
Okay, interesting. So, what type of, were you given a briefing in regards to what was going on the U.S. thing, the end of things?
Yeah.
You were strictly serving as a defensive patrol.
Yeah, but we could know very easily. We'd exercise with ships and other nations. So,
were you given a specific mission or responsibility?
Yes, but I don't recall it specifically how it's worked. Go to this area, operate in conjunction with the U.S. forces of the individual assistance, and conduct surveillance to attempt to detect enemies.
So there were a lot of Russian, it seems like there was a lot of Russian fishing or Soviet fishing vessels.
Oh, yes.
So you had to kind of discern between what was legitimate
and some of those fishing vessels, I noticed a couple of them down there. They're called, the NATO term for them was AGIs, which were, they were intelligence directors. They looked like fishing vessels. Their spy ships.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the only way you can tell is that they behaved in a disciplined manner
in the fishing lines. So, in a situation like where you came across the submarine or the fishing vessel that was obviously gathering data, what were you to do? Just to contact somebody to confirm that that was indeed a Soviet?
First of all, you detect it, you identify it, you report it. You may then track it, either be, track it on your own volition or be told to track it.
Now, were you to be blocking their path from carrying on, or just strictly keeping an eye?
No, our job was to not to block them, but to detect them somehow.
Mm-hmm. in regards to, I know through NATO and through NORAD, there was like a fair amount of affiliation with the U.S. forces. But as far as your Navy work was concerned, were you affiliated at all with the U.S.?
Only through the Scandinavian U.S. Defense, Navy Defense. Again, you know, we're talking about 1962, much later on. For example, I was Deputy Chief of Staff Operations for the Supreme Allied Commander Atlantic for 3 years. So that's eventually a different situation.
Yeah. We talked about that one. Now, just I had another kind of political question. Diefenbaker had said, actually on the 5th of November, not shortly after tensions had cooled a little bit, that he thought it would be extreme to say that we were on the brink of war, and that he felt it was necessary to have consultations with the UN before engaging in this sort of thing again. Now, I wondered what kind of feeling this would leave on U.S.-Canadian relations militarily, in your opinion. Do you think the Canadian reaction cooled the U.S. to us at all? Or?
Yes.
Yeah. Do you think it had an impact?
When you believe that you're a nation like the United States is under clear threat, a missile attack from Cuba, which recognizes that it would be the nation attacked first. And your lifelong friend and ally does not immediately come to your assistance with all means possible and render you moral support as well in public opinion. I think there's a likelihood that you can.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What about within the Navy or within the military? Was there any feelings of that perhaps you weren't being used to the best of your ability?
I don't think there was a feeling that we weren't being used to the best of our ability because we got on with the job. Those of us who were sitting in at that time. I suppose there was a feeling that perhaps we should have applied far more. But again, it's very difficult for me to relate to how I feel now, looking back at it the way I did as a lieutenant, who is concerned just with getting on with the ship, training his people, making sure that if push comes to shove, that he can fire his weapons and fire them accurately. Mm-hmm. So, different order of mechanism.
Yeah.
One is political consideration that doesn't enter your mind.
At the time,
Very few diplomats and politicians in trenches.
That's true. And never make it there. Just from your perspective, did you feel that the role that Canada played in the crisis was a crucial one?
I think it would have left a big gap. Remember that the United States commitments worldwide were eaten at that time. Our naval contribution was probably a significant amount at the time, smaller than it was. You have to look at, in a Navy, is what's available in the area of interest. And something that's 10,000 miles away doing something else is of no consequence. So you look at what you've got and what your friends got. How well are you teaming together? You might say under those circumstances we probably played a much greater role than most people would give us credit for or understand.
Mm-hmm. Now going back to when you were at sea, you talked about, or on the movie it talked about the secret SOSIS?
SOSIS, Sensible Surveillance System.
Okay, could you explain what that, or are you able to...
No.
Okay.
I think to get, oh, I know what it's about. I've visited the stations. We didn't know exactly where the rays were. But let me tell you something about sound water. If you emit sound in water, whether it be from sonar or anything else, there are two things, well, three things that govern how far away that sound can be heard. One is